Okay, welcome to You Talking with Greg. I'm super excited today to be with Jill Nephew, who I'd seen in these spaces talk about natural intelligence. I listened to one of your podcasts a while ago. I was like, what is that? And then Jill and I had a conversation. Peter Lindbergh hooked us up. And we've been sharing ideas, and it's been really fascinating for the last 4 weeks or whatever. I've started to dip my toe into natural intelligence and like, oh, I think that Jill's really onto something very, very profound here. And Jill's been dancing a little bit in U-Talk, and you know, we'll see what she thinks about that. But Jill, welcome.
Thank you. Awesome. I'm really looking forward to this too. It's great.
To be here. So, well, why don't we just give the audience a chance to get to know you a little bit? Tell us a little bit about your journey into this space. I think you're known in relationship to natural intelligence, but you can give us just a little bit of history to situate how you got to be where you are today.
Yeah, that's actually relevant for what we want to talk about, because I think that that is, I'll be pulling from all that in today's discussion heavily. So my background, like many people in our circles, was, heavy in the wisdom traditions early in life. So I was officially ordained. We can talk about what that means later in a fourth way tradition, my early mid-20s. Was very serious, I was one of the earnest seekers in my early years. At the same time, I was doing that kind of coincidentally, I spent a lot of the time working at a natural foods cafe that serviced Sonoma State University. So all my friends tend to be studying psychology. Okay. And I'm in Northern California. So there's just a ton of crosstalk and overlap. And back then we were very promiscuous. Like everyone checked out each other's teachers, we all just were into, and back then too, all the teachers would dialogue together. They would, there was a lot of combined talks. So a lot of what I'm seeing now was actually in a small way in that neighborhood, was happening there as well. These kind of dialogues and cross traditions. So a lot of the problems I think that people are wrestling with, today were people were even wrestling with then, maybe articulated a slightly different way, but seriously, the problem of transmission, the problem of how do you scale this stuff out? How do you, deal with the fact that you're kind of in this subordinate model or this like teacher student role, but you want your students to somehow grow up in a way that is beyond, in some different way. So that's a lot there to wrestle with, which I don't think we're going to touch on here, but there's a lot to wrestle with there that I've been wrestling with for a long time. And I was one of the people a lot also what you see today. So I'm same age, 53 now. So we're talking about the 80s, 90s. Just curious about everything I could find in terms of group stuff, and checked out all the different ways, encounter groups go back to the 70s. So you see, there was all kinds of weird stuff always, check this out, check that out, try to make up your own. Like
emotion workshops. Scream therapy, huh?
Therapy. Oh, I did all kinds of weird stuff. I ran one workshop, which was like kind of esoteric theater workshop, where you would spend the entire evening at a cocktail party in character as yourself, so you had to be like kind of this uncanny version of yourself. Self-observation, actually, like, have you caught yourself enough in the act where you can kind of impartially represent yourself very accurately, knowing that you're just doing it as an act, stuff like that. So that's that was going on. Right? Well, I would argue Gurdjieff was very meta-modern. We can get into that another time. Yeah. So, and in my early 30s, just by the by, my grandfather remarried my new adopted grandmother. We really enjoyed each other, and she invited me to her group thing that she was doing. This was a group of older ladies, mostly over 70. I was the only person 30 in the room. The person running it was a 94-year-old Quaker, and it was a weekend workshop thing they had done for 15 years. They get together once or twice a year to do this, this workshop run by this 94-year-old Quaker. And they don't fly her out. And I was invited to join along, which the ladies were not super happy about, but by the end of the weekend, they were okay with it. And then they liked it. And so like, it's okay, you, but no more young people. It's like, we want this to be like our thing. So it was a huge window in, as you probably know, with like palliative psychology. Like if you look at ontology, the intersection of meaning making psychology and ontology, cancer, basically end of life. Mm. There's a whole different way you approach people that are dealing with end of life. And so that's a lens. You don't fix anybody in under 90s anymore. Right. And most people in the room were lifelong therapists and had been through a lot. Like there are people in the room that are in Auschwitz and 40-year therapists. One woman's in Auschwitz herself. Her sister survived, her parents didn't. people in the room who had lost all three sons to wars. And, you know, like, I mean, people had suffered. There's a blue baby part of the group, a woman who back in the day, there's something called a blue baby, which was this knowledge that if a baby isn't like nurtured, held, kept warm, they would become like suicidal as babies. They turn blue. They stop breathing, and they call them blue babies. And it's like, it was just known that this baby isn't getting the fundamental mammal needs met, and they're just losing their will to live. And I'm watching these people process, you know, we're all processing together. And this format run by this Quaker kind of blew my mind. And the reason I say it's a format by the Quaker is that she actually fell in love in her 90s and remarried and wanted to spend the rest of her years out in Massachusetts, where we were flying her in from to California. And so the group decided it would run itself, but we had all these seasoned therapists, and they started bringing in all of their methodologies and their processes, and the whole group blew up. The processes they had learned in therapy weren't working in the same way that this other process is working. And when I saw that, and it was really sad, so they stopped meeting. We tried a couple times, and I saw what was going on, and I thought, what is going on with that format? And so that was early to, so I feel like I got, and I now can say what that was, and I'm sure we'll get time, you know, but I was like, that's something special, and I got to figure out what to do with that. So I spent eight years thinking about what to do with it. In 2009, quit my job to try to put it in a bottle and figure out how can I have other people have the experience I had. And so when I was in those groups, I felt like I was getting, I said it was like water. Like I felt like I was missing so fundamental. It was like water. I was getting water, and I didn't even know I was missing water. And the other thing I'd say at the time is like, it was like I was climbing up Everest, and I could have finally the bird's eye view of life. And what I said was like, just listening to the ordinary stories of the people around me about their ordinary lives, not trying, only intention was to, they're, you know, led through this, what we now consider natural intelligence process, where you'd be given an open question, go off alone for maybe 45 minutes to reflect on your own life, bring back art, expression, collage it in, and you just be listening and getting these lenses into people's life, very ordinary. And that's it, move on. There's nothing to fix now, right? Because this is like we're not there anymore. We're just being with it as it is. So, you know, the old age is enlightenment at gunpoint, right? So people are really being with the existential givens in this very clean way. And I was like, these are the stories I need to hear, because these are the people around me. This is what's actually happening here. This is like waking up in the matrix. Like I am in media land where I'm hearing stories of what life is. And now these are the people on the ground that I see at the grocery store. This is what's really going on in their heads. And oh my God, I don't even know what's going on in other people's heads for real around me here. And I am completely ungrounded, and I'm in the ether. I'm a spiritual blah, blah, you know, and I'm just up here. And I need this. I need to know what life's actually like on this planet right now from the people around me. And that is, you know, what I called at the time, like wisdom. Like I'm starving for it. Okay. I know I'm starving for it. And so when I quit my job later to go do the thing
pause you for a second.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I know a major feature of natural intelligence is to free ourselves from the parasites of thought.
Yeah. That's
Right. So this is an early experience of that. You encounter this whereby there's a contrast between the present scene of some authentic awareness that is afforded here in and of itself that you gain contact with. And then you see the world apart from that. And it's just like, oh my God, there's a fundamental difference in the realness and the wisdom of this present scene relative to the world that we're in.
Yeah, the juxtaposition was like, blatant and huge gap. And I had not seen that in other group modes. We can go into why that is, but you know, it's quite clear to me now why. Like the conditions were set just right by this Quaker, and a lot of the Quaker tradition also has the right understanding assumptions and the right, you know, respect for individual connection to, you know, has a lot of the right conditions that would emerge maybe from a Quaker practice. But anyway, that was the huge juxtaposition. And I quit my job many years later, 2009, to start this project to try to solve that problem. I wanted to figure out what that was and disseminate it to the world. And why don't we pause there? we can pick up from there later, but that was the beginning of Inquire, and that was the beginning of everything followed from that need and what I learned along the way. Right. But then in the interim, the other crosscut of my life is kind of my professional life. So I wasn't a professional meditation teacher, a professional wisdom teacher, whatever they call them, you know, wisdom person. I didn't want to go that direction. I now can kind of see why, but I think that I was really locked onto this wisdom thing. Like whenever I felt like I was listening to somebody, I'd be like, oh, sorry, I'm 25 and I have so much more to learn from you than you have to learn from me. I just couldn't get that I had anything to teach anybody. Even, you know, I really struggled with that. So I thought, well, I'm not going to I don't know what to do yet with this idea that I've learned something from my teacher. I don't know what to do with that yet. So that's a whole nother thing. Right. But what in the interim, I went off and had for my father, a penchant for really thinking about meta, how to solve problems, how to, you know, he was a trained as a mechanical engineer, but got his foot in the door through all kinds of research programs and was always working on cutting edge stuff and PhD level teams. And so, and it was all kind of, you know, really a passion about like how you approach problems, how you reason, you know, how you work your way through things. And really, really, it was clearly his love as to his reasoning. Probably not coincidentally, the Gurdjieff system is about progressing through higher degrees of reason. That's like, if there's a staged model, it's about like, how do you bring emotions into reasoning? How do you bring body into reasoning? How do you, that once you get those synced up, you kind of get to this different level of reasoning, and it keeps kind of growing out. And I think it really parallels this idea, you know, we could talk about monocognitized points, pointing at that, but opening up the capacity to reason outside of yourself now. Mm-hmm. So your reasoning is the foundation of compassion, altruism, everything else. It's a growing ability of higher degrees of reasoning.
Mm-hmm. Well, so we'll make a plug in there to UTalk, because the insight around UTalk starts with justification, which is a close cousin of reason. So
Right. And that was one thing I thought would be interesting for us to dive into. I don't know if we'll get here this time, but
anyway, we'll just make that word contact. Yeah,
definitely. There's that to do. So I wanted to go to engineering track too, but I got completely taken by physics. I'm not great at calculating things.
Taken by physics?
Yeah, because actually, well, this might be relevant later. You don't do a lot of calculating in physics. You do a lot of imagining, and people don't realize that the calculating's for the engineers. So I remember my dad, like, just, I remember one meeting I had my dad, you know, he died when I was young. It was before I went on my career later. But when I was first starting my career thinking I was going to be an engineer, I'm like, he's like, Jill, you have to be able to compute things. You know, I'm like, I can't get the right answer. I get all the right concepts, right? I'm top of the class in concepts. So I remember I went to study physics. And I remember that actually I did one graduate course in applied differential geometry for people that want to work on general relativity. And the teacher said, okay, you losers, like, for this one homework problem, you have to get out your calculator and calculate a number of, you know, as a square capacitor problem. We're going to start with the unit list, all very abstract. But at the end, you're going to plug in some numbers and you're going to get the number.
Oh, God.
Whole class got it wrong. No one could get the number out right. And that tells you something. There's a big difference between engineering and we all try. You can't get the right number. Software saves you from that because it doesn't run when you get it wrong. So that's nice. Anyway, so I got very interested and passionately in love with the idea of physics, applied physics, and went into soft condensed matter physics. Soft condensed matter physics is, I'm pointing that out because it requires you to think in many different ways. So people are aware of a particle wave duality, you know, that's kind of, everyone's heard that one. But a lot of people don't appreciate it. Really truly is a duality. And if you had to take a side, you take the side of wave, not particles, the elusive, the wave's the real part. But when people think often in physics or naive physics, or when they think they're, you know, what you see what's out in the world, it's still Newtonian. I know you pointed that too. It's still, everything's Newtonian. Yep. So it's bird's eye view, parts and particles, and it's not. And so I often say one way to check your thinking is just go to a single person perspective in a fluid system, and you'll see, you'll see things break down. You'll see, there's lots of assumptions here. This doesn't really apply as generally as I thought, because I can't say it for a fluid continuous system. Right. So soft condensed matter is kind of this mess where, in a similar way, you have to think in what's called real space and phase space. You have to consider like the strength of chemical bonds, which are very kind of Newtonian. And you also have to think of the strength of like the global inverse space, where everything global becomes local and everything local becomes global. Mm. So you have to like kind of do this inside out move where you, if you think in an inverse space, you So if you, well, the classic is like a sine wave goes on forever. Yep. A single wave goes on in real space forever, but in frequency space, it's just a single point. It's the frequency. So you're doing this kind of like from global to local. So that kind of move in your thinking, there's some moves you learn in physics, and you have to be able to switch. In soft condensed matter, you have to be able to decide, think of the problem in both ways, and then figure out at what point do they, one dominate or the other. So I was already thinking in this way, and then
A tree coin relation, by the way. Coin at the frequency, and then tree at the hole.
Yeah. That's what that's what I'm saying. I think you have a lot of the gestalts there, and so maybe walking through this journey, we'll start to.
That's really cool.
It's going to be this non-linear light up process.
Right. I'm just popping in. It's like, God, I can connect to that point.
Yeah. I think that's right. And one thing. So let me back up and tell now a little storytelling about this. I realized this also in my reflection preparing for this call. I get into a lot of back and forth in the liminal web with people, and probably people in general, anyone outside of that have experienced the academy, have experienced sciences, that I tend to defend science a lot stronger than anybody else. Like I'm just, and a lot of people see that kind of almost misguided or delusional that I take such a strong stand for science. And so I feel like this is an important story to get out there, which is that I did some reflecting on that. I thought, Jill, you are really making an error here to assume that everyone's had the same science experience you had. Like I sought out a very specific experience in the sciences that most people didn't have. Yep. And so the crosscut was first I was going to do physics, which is very abstract and deals with unknown. And then not only that, I looked for a program where I could do undergraduate research, and I ended up at Santa Cruz. And Santa Cruz has an open door policy when I visited that program, where all the professors keep their door open. You can walk in anytime and talk to them about anything. Then Santa Cruz moved to this other building that had all this common space. And I know Jill Edelman talks about this, the quality of spaces instead of tubes. So they're very aware of this bringing back the commons, kind of the wisdom commons of physics. So much so that like as an undergrad, the reverse started happening. I walked in the hall and a professor, like a well-known professor working on some very advanced topic and, later in life, would be like, do you have a minute? Pull me in his office and start, can I try to explain this to you? Because of that because the articulate, it comes out. Yeah, it comes out through the explaining. And I was trying to catch up and he's just trying to explain it to me. And this is also an environment where I remember I just started out learning physics. And you work through things sequentially, and the problems with the way you learn it is revealed later. Yep. So I was starting out electricity and magnetism, and I said, this isn't right, because I can imagine this case it's not right. So I went to my professor, I said, if Einstein came up with this or whoever came up with this, it's wrong. I said, this is wrong. And when you do that, you get handed the chalk. You don't get told, no, how could you be right and Einstein be wrong? You just have to say, I've got a problem here that's not likely, but I don't know what else to do with this.
Right.
And the chalk. So I'd walk through my thing, like, so you have this problem with a solenoid and like this term wasn't handled that case. And you have this time problem. You'd be like, oh, right. That's Einstein realized that. And we're going to learn that in the next chapter. Like, okay, great. So I actually had the sense that my thinking might just advance things. And this actually started when I was at my community college. I was a high school dropout. I went to community college and I took my first physics class at community college. We were learning the slinkies and the springs and the slinkies and the springs. And I was like, so we're standing waves on a string and the slinky, compression waves on the slinky. So I went to my teacher. I'm like, what about if you have a transverse wave on a slinky, like a mix them together.
Right.
Like, what about that case? And she says, oh, I don't think anyone's ever thought about that. I'm like, how's it possible no one's thought about that? I'm in a world where people don't think about things. Like I didn't even know that about science. Like there's all these things people have never thought about. Like I've always in this frame of like, science just tells you we know everything and what we know.
There's like edges of our knowledge and gaps.
And so she said, try it out. So I remember like just hammering with the math I knew and ended up with this like 8-page paper that I worked on of like, how far can I get with this? And here's how it all breaks down. And I don't have the math for this. And I only know how to conceptualize this part. And it really gave me that first taste of like the whole end to end of how the sausage is made of like, I need math to try to articulate my ideas, which is what I hear you struggling with. You're that's what it's for.
Right.
I had my
calculus in my first year in physics, and then I left
that's not the right tools.
I never returned to that. And I'm jealous of that in some ways, but I developed my own language.
But the thing is that, we're going to maybe come back to this, but one thing you learn if you go through the whole arc of it, it's a grad school and you start doing all the applied physics I've done, where you go now in graduate school, I did biophysics and and climate science,
right?
And those are earth science, basically. And those are both systems where, you know, they're real systems, right?
Sure.
They're real world systems. Most of science is done in closed systems. And that's the other thing I was going to point out. People do not appreciate that when people say anything, like anything about science, if there's anything that put into words, it's because the system is fully constrained in a certain way with certain assumptions, and you have to bring all that in. And you know that, like, a real scientist reads the procedures, the methodology, like, how did you set it up? Because I'm going to see where you screwed up setting it up. And if you screwed up the way you set it up, I don't care what you say anymore, because you screwed up.
That's not the right system. The whole structure. And
right.
Therefore everything
right?
That's going to follow.
Yeah. But people that consume science that don't understand that about science, accidentally, no matter how rigorous they are, they're creating pseudoscience because they don't know how to do that reasoning to say, let me see exactly the context where this is relevant and make sure I'm not violating anything by putting it into another context. And that's that also comes, it's crucial. And it comes up a lot when dealing with these communities that are wanting to do science, but aren't willing to, or don't know how much work it takes to, you know, if you're going to go into a new domain and use their science, you really have to understand the origins and do all this background reading and seminal work reading. And you need to really do a lot and then check your thinking with somebody who knows that space. Like you really, there's a whole arc of work you need to do before you can adopt a science that is more work than I think people imagine. So going back to the story that I think might be helpful to you with the UTalk is that, you know, the lovely thing, it's very much like Advaita. I think it's very much like an Advaita path where, at least the one I experienced when I do the exercise with Rupert Spira is very intellectual about it. You know, you are doing these thought experiments. Rupert Spira is doing these thought experiments where it's like, well, where's the edge of your consciousness? Was it there a moment ago? Does it follow? When does it go away? Like all these things that get you to realize the edge of your knowing.
Yep.
And then in that, there's this like the way it's explained is just like all of a sudden there's this sense of like this way I thought this thing was trustworthy is not, but this other thing is much more trustworthy I thought wasn't. So you kind of adjust your trustworthiness landscape. And that happens. I was saying a similar thing I think happens in applied sciences that people don't recognize. So, you know, yeah, you have the ineffable, you have the tacit knowledge of like a climate scientist who's looked at tons and tons of earth data. And when he looks at data, he says, that doesn't look right. And you say, explain why. It doesn't mean there's words, but you can trust his thinking. Like, you know, there's a whole, you're using that whole abductive inference layer, everything you've come to know from just having all that experience with the system to know when things don't add up.
Yep.
And so that's what's going on in the minds of scientists. And then that very intimate awareness of what a small subset you can use math with, you can solve the math, a bunch of equations you can write down you can't solve.
Yep.
You know, like you could that haven't been solved before, that, you know, where can you even use them? And that's a very, very small sliver of the knowledge that a scientist holds. And that's what we've lost respect for, which is wrong. Like that is what we're losing in this country right now. It's horrible. We need to recouple that tacit knowledge. Mm-hmm. How has this person spent their life? Respect that a mind does all kinds of amazing things. And if that person spent all their time looking at termites, they are the expert on termites. You're not, they are. They you may say, why can't you just tell me this about termites? And I'd be like, you don't know anything.
Yeah.
Like, there's no languaging for it.
I'll position this with an example that people may appreciate. So I'm pretty sure this is the right person. Doesn't really matter. But there was a chess grandmaster. I think it was Jose Capablanca. And he was getting interviewed. And they were asking him, hey, how many moves do you see when you look at the chessboard? You know, and how many moves do you see of one? And he's like, I see one move, the right one.
Right, exactly.
So he can't tell you, you know, it's like he can't unbreak it up anymore in any propositional knowledge. He just sees the gestalt of the chessboard and all of that tacit knowledge is brought to bear at a gestalt structure. And it's like, you move the pawn to king four and that's the end of it, you know? It's I see one
exactly,
move, the right one.
Exactly.
It's an interesting way to capture this kind of knowledge. So
yeah, and this just came up. I was just talking to Ari in the Air, if you know his podcast,
sure,
and we were talking about paragliding.
Several times.
Yeah, awesome. I'm still catching up. I didn't realize everyone's been on there. I got to listen to everybody now there. So a lot of people I want to listen to there. But yeah, that experience with the paragliding is very much like that 3D chess with the sky. It's invisible. And then that's also where you get a tremendous amount. So I also started paragliding at 24, spent more of my life paragliding than not. So I have that layer where I understand the power of this non-languageable layer. And how it's running now invisible simulations. So if you need to tell me, what do I see? I'd be like, it's invisible, first off, you know, so we've got that going against us. It's, you know, I'm visualizing invisible air and I'm seeing patterns in the invisible, and it's showing me lines and it's showing me things. And it shows you things in your whole body, like where you're just certain in your whole body. Like there's just that, you could, it's like a feeling to it where you perfectly see the line, you perfectly see what's going on in the invisible, and that it's trustworthy. So you get these continual confirmations, because you, the only way to win competitions is that you're not trustworthy one time, but 1,000 times over 6 hours. You're continually to have the right map, right map, right map, and you're competing against maps. So I think it's such a wonderful sport to think about, like the how, yeah. And then you think, oh my God, I'm so ingenious. I'm a human. I can figure all this out. And then, like, you know, every bird is better than you. So like, right. Brain this big, you know, like follow them. If you see a bird, it's like, follow the bird. Yeah, the bird. What are you doing? I'm going to follow you. I'm not going to follow you. I'm going to follow the bird.
Intelligence, yeah, right?
Exactly. Absolutely. You're living it, and you're designed for it. So we all follow birds over people. I have lots of stories of like, there I was and I saw a bird. Yes. We're just going to follow that bird.
Lovely.
Yeah. So I think that just anchoring back to that, I did a long run with the trying out being a scientist, also realizing the community doesn't, you know, there's all these problems in the academy, which I relate to, all the problems people complain about I've experienced. And also kind of what I was pointing out, so I got that golden time with the physicists where I felt like, that's how I want the whole academy to work. And I know you talk about the deficit of like how psychology in some areas of psychology, or maybe in the entire field, I think you've said that, you know, they don't even see that interested at that level. They're still, you know, they're kind of in the pragmatics, you know, and then we know that there's also a missing model altogether of like no mechanism in psychiatry of the biological model. Like where, you know, I've seen that there's, I don't know if you know this, but the hearing, Agnes's Jacket, the author of that person in that book written, written by a woman who's very interested in first person accounts of psychosis, went crazy listening to them, then went on and got a PhD and kind of contrasts what she learned from people that had direct experience with the academy. She had mentioned that, I don't know if it's still out there, but there's this check made out to the American Psychiatric Association for $3,000 or something. Like, if you can show a mechanism, you know, of the biological hypothesis of the chemical imbalance model, we'll give you this check. Because they're basically saying, if it does have a biological mechanism, it'll be in neurology or endocrinology, or, you know, like it'll be in neuroscience, because that's where it belongs. If there's a mechanism, if there's not a mechanism. So they're really kind of pushing that kind of common sense reasoning there.
Yeah. Well,
so,
right. Certainly. Yeah. So the beauty of physics, and I've always appreciated physics, in my estimation, essentially, obviously I'd be really interested at some point to talk to you about the edges of physics, dark energy, dark matter, these kinds of notions. But there's the foundational core, obviously, what happens with the Enlightenment is the foundational core of a knowledge system around matter and motion, and then the growth in relationship to that. And you get an ontology and an epistemology, at least within that system, that gives us, as far as I'm concerned, a transcendent realist picture of the universe. We'll see if aliens would agree with us. But for me, then that's like, okay, and that's super exciting. There is, go ahead.
Oh, I do. Well, I would like to drill down on that, since that was one of the points I wanted to bring up. But this is the time. But do you want to finish your point about psychology before?
No, I love psychology, but there's a tremendously profound contrast at the level of ontological specificity in my field.
Well, I think that yes, and I think that physics also isn't scot-free. That's what I was trying to point out, is the culture I got to experience, not the field. Mm-hmm. So I have this I got to see something kind of working, but still being held back by unexamined assumptions. And this is where, if we want to go full circle, we have to come back to the transcendent realism point. So we'll click on that, but what I wanted to kind of point out was that what I see being uneven, so we haven't gotten there yet, but what Inquirer tried to explicate through open-ended question forms, things that access tacit knowledge, access to this, you know, the languaging around that, what came out of that project, was what seems like almost a complete calculus of reason and these 12 dimensions of reason. And if you take those 12 dimensions of reason, you can, and the questions associated with them, you could actually use them to interrogate the sciences and show, like what I just showed, just this is the reasoning that's missing. And when you talk about the Enlightenment gap, the way I formulate that is that the way to show this is through counterfactual reasoning. Okay. Thought experiments are counterfactual. Like, well, sure. So, you know, what about this and what about that? Those are counterfactual. It's not, let's talk about what is. Uh-huh. The Enlightenment, as I understand, said, why would we ever use the imaginal, which is crazy, psychotic, weird, you know, untrustworthy, and imagination counterfactual, let's just stick to the facts. And that kind of became kind of like logical positivism, and all that went kind of underground. So the stories I heard Adam Becker tell in What Is Real, in that book, and may not be correct, but I'm going to be referencing that book. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like you had that as the backdrop of Enlightenment, and then you had the 40s come along, or maybe before the 40s, but you know, the bomb come along. Mm-hmm. And basically that was kind of the nail in the coffin, where it's like, shut up and compute. And now people are very critical about that. And that's now known that foundations of physics was abandoned, and it became almost shameful. And so kind of speaking to all the shame about the fact that we kind of rewrote history, rewrote science to seem facts-based, to seem like it's about this data-oriented thing, where the real heavy lifting of it is still this abductive inference, the warm data, as Nora Bateson would put it, but that's where the real thing's happening. It has to be there, axiomatic, according to Judea Pearl. There's like no way around it. People said it's axiomatic too, and he just wrote a book about it, which helps me a lot. Just me trying to do the proofs, which I wrote a book about trying to do the proofs, and that was like, I don't want to think that hard. So read his book, you know, and you can show it's axiomatic that you can't get new insights from a closed system. You have to think outside the system. No free lunch theorem, all the incomplete, all these problems that say you, like it or not, this machine, this naturally intelligent machine, has capacities that cannot be replicated, can't happen in our, what we love, our closed systems, our logical systems, our models. We have to step into that ineffable, and then insight comes out of that space. And so that's how it works. That's how science happens. That's why it's always disruptive. That's why it's always paradigm shifting, because that thing ungrounds. It's a global operation. That global local thing, the models tend to be often reified as parts, and then the insights happen in another space that has this redo the whole thing potentially. So it's a dangerous game. And a lot of the scientific endeavor in the academy isn't really set up to support those disruptions, right? People have to die.
The reverse.
Yeah, the reverse. Kind of the reverse. People have to die because it's, if we could just be reasonable about it, we'd be like, okay, thank you for your work. Your whole model has been disrupted. We're going to shout it from the rooftops. This is no longer valid science. You should not be ashamed of that. Like, we're going to help you, you know, but you have this stuff hanging around that's dead and disproven, and the little things that disprove it get this much attention. And the thing that's disproven keeps getting this much attention. And this is a huge problem we have now.
Once you get an institutional inertia, the momentum of an institutional inertia structure, and the way in which that the current institutional system operates is really troublesome, especially how much upgrading to our operating system we actually need. So it is a real big engineering problem.
Yeah.
And it's like we need to scrap everything, get rid of the parasites, and find our natural intelligence path.
Yeah, pretty much, right? And that's what they told me. Like, when I quit to do this job, I have a lot of respect for the academy. I know that's full of people that think really hard about things. They do think deeply about things. They don't get to express all they know. I've had people in psychology come take me aside in conferences and say, thank you for writing this book. I was going to write a book, all this stuff. Someday, hopefully I will too, but I was telling her I was going to put all this in a book. And she said, thank you for writing this. It would be the end of my career to write this stuff up. Like, I can't come out and say these things. Mm-hmm. And then when I started the project, I went to UCSF psychiatry, because at the time they're the leaders of they're doing a bunch of work on computer technology and the psyche, right? So they're the ones that are kind of thinking about that and positive psychology. So I presented to them and I said, what should I do? And they said, I said, first off, and this is another thing that's important about this project, is that I came at it like an engineer. And I haven't talked about that yet, but my professional history was building these large computer systems, just like my dad, and solvers and planners, and basically building artificial brains to solve big, hard problems for people. And in that role, I'm very comfortable saying, you're the one who has the tacit knowledge, not me. I think that that's another thing that the liminal web doesn't do very well, is like, if I come on an insight, if I have a hunch about something after thinking about this long, it's quite likely that hunch is right. Those are cool. but go find somebody who's stared it down for 20 years. See what happens to them. See what, like, see what they wrote about it. See what people said about what they said. Like, you, so that became like my methodology was like, I already know I'm going to be, I'm an engineer. I'm looking for designs. I'm going to the people that know the stuff. And I'm going to use those principles to try to build a machine to reproduce this thing I experienced with the Quakers and distribute it to the world. And so, you know, that mindset, is, you know, very different from, say, like, oh, I think there's something there, so I'm going to continue to invest in my insight, right? So I have a lot of respect for people that, you know, understand, like, that's why I see a lot of parallel in our work, is that, you know, that you aren't just saying, hey, I have an idea, you know, you're like, I'm going to try to go dive as deep as I can, and I'm going to be humble about, I'm pulling from this, and I want you to see this together, and because where else can I do it but here? And so that's what the feedback I got from the, when I consulted with the psychiatrist at UCSF, said, build what you're going to build outside the academy. You will never get anywhere here. It's going to take too long. And I'd come with my list, like, do you have a list of these? Do you have a taxonomy for this? I'm like, I need these categorizations. I need a list of these things. If I'm going to build this machine, this is my list. And they say, we aren't asking those questions back to my undergrad. That's not our research agenda, you know? So they're like, make up your own and have us study it. So I had to kind of just do this, you know, try to make my methodology transparent, present back to the academy, which I've done, and make it hopefully good enough someday that it can match back up with their rigor, but I couldn't do it inside the academy. And I think that you're
empathize with that.
I maintain
my professor job, my passion and my life ended up basically now people don't know what the hell to do with me. We'll put it that way.
I relate to that too. So
you're
just for, good enough of me kind of downloading.
One thing I will have you say, because you make a nice analogy with climate science, okay, like I think you said something along the lines of, do we understand the whole climate? No. Okay. But there are things we do understand that we can do. And you jump off that from in the meta crisis. Can you say a little bit about that?
That's analogy? A good point. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to explain that. That's really useful. So the climate problem, studying that in graduate school, and not only studying it from the science perspective, but I also did, we also actively were part of like talking to different people trying to have influence in the world, right? So it's like really, and then I left that program wanting to kind of, same time Al Gore came out with his message, I was wanting to get people to reason through the climate and follow reasoning arguments instead of the way people were thinking about, which was contentious and polarizing. Very much, I can map it right into the lower level, higher level cognition. In fact, it's the same example Judea Pearl used in this book, the same argument I was going to, similar argument where I would say, look, you don't need, so here's what it looks like, is that we knew enough to know what to do with the climate in like the 60s, and we haven't learned much else since then. From as a pure science perspective, we can't be fortune tellers because there's only one Earth. And we don't, everyone say we don't understand it. It's too wild. It could go lots of different ways. We don't have enough of the story to predict it. But we can do a thought experiment, and just the higher level cognition, where we can take two identical Earths and we add more CO2 to one. And now I could walk you through an argument where I'm just only bringing those fundamental physics that are, anything else would be impossible. It's like you're arguing about like atomic decay. You're arguing about like the conservation laws, like there's this impossibility to reasoning that we bring in without realizing it. And I point out to people, you know all this, you just don't realize it. You can follow this argument and be thoroughly persuaded that we are going to pay a huge economic price for this in mid-latitudes, and like a ton of infrastructure is going to get destroyed, and all these things follow from this argument. And you don't have to like measure anything. We already know this. And you can, and the problem with the climate is that by the time you measure it, you're 200 years before you can make a difference. It's 200 years, and that's for the CO2. For the anything in the oceans, you have 5,000 years. Like, oh, we messed up. Okay, let's wait another 5,000 years and see if we fixed it. So you have to use thought experiments, and we aren't. And this is why we're in each other's arms, crying all the time, because we could see that gap between how we are learning how to reason, studying an N of one system, versus how people are thinking about the problem. So I go out and give a talk. I wanted to educate people with church groups or, you know, classrooms. And I try this. I'd try to give this reasoned argument, and always to be like the hand at the end and be like, I'm not sure if I follow what you said, but are you saying that the current warming is due to us or not? And I was like, that's, I just spent an hour trying to explain to you why that's not the right question. I got nowhere. I got absolutely nowhere. And I, at that point, I was like, I can't solve the climate problem until I solve the natural intelligence problem. Like, we're not thinking right to even know how to begin this problem. The average person, we don't approach problems this way. And I just started seeing that everywhere. And I abandoned the whole, there's no point pushing at that level. That, you know, this has to be solved at a different level. And that also fed into this project. You know, eventually when I started seeing all these pieces getting together, I'm like, ah, good, this is going to get at that. Because I'm like, until we can get people to think differently, no one's going to be asking the right questions. No one's going to be able to do the right simulations to see so clearly what the what follows by this by this reasoning.
Okay.
So, yeah. And so this kind of, so coming back to the enlightenment gap, I think you say that well, that to me, the enlightenment gap is that we habitually go to that lower level causal data, parts, whole, beyond Newtonian way of thinking habitually. And then we stop there when there aren't answers there to answer at the higher level thought experiment reasoning. And you see how a rationalist view can shut down those arguments and shouldn't still, you know, and so this is like a pushback, the beginning of a pushback. It's what Judea Pearls thinks is happening as a causal revolution. Like he's starting to see people waking up to this. I feel like I'm seeing it too. Like we're starting to wake up to it now. So I think this next century hopefully will be a lot better than the last one. We really got to clean up the last century. So yeah, so I think all that's coming online. And then I wanted to make one more thing that I realized I wanted to fill in, that double click on thing.
Please.
That I feel like you might be an aha for you. I think just take it wherever you want to go. But the last little aha thing maybe might be to look at the calculus of variation, like Leibniz's work. Yeah, so basically that was the insight that you can do God's eye view Newtonian physics, where you say, let's just figure out all the forces and every point in space and calculate. Or you can do this wild thing that Leibniz came up with of we're only going to look at the neighborhood around a point, of one little point, and that little point of reference will have a state that is going to somehow magically be a perfect mirror of the whole universe. And if we just interrogate that, do the math on that scalar, not vectors across all space, but pick a point of reference and then do a certain kind of math on that, we actually implicitly construct the whole world around us such that we get a better answer. And that is how most of physics is done. It's not done. They abandoned bird's eye. It's done through calculus of variations. That's the Hamiltonian. That's like the, you know, the, all the normal ways you think about is it's done. Physics moved on. And physics, so, but they left behind kind of back to this problem. We have the problem of what gets reified in the scientific community, which we know is problematic. And then what I kind of say to people is I say to me, you know, if you had to size it, like that's the problem's that big there. What you're experiencing is this layer outside it, which is how it's communicated, how we're educated, how the media handles it, this whole shell of BS, which further reifies things and says, this is true in any context, science says. And it's like, you're being completely indoctrinated with BS. And if you actually go to do the science, you'll get underneath those layers eventually. It gets to this Tootsie Roll, unless you're an unfortunate field. And there are some that stop at statistics because statistics doesn't ground. Statistics blocks that. So if you only way you know is through statistics, you you and Judea Pearl points this out too, like you've got a real problem with statistics that you you can kind of start to get there at Bayesian, but you don't fully get there because Bayesian also doesn't allow for all kinds of dynamics that, you know, that are, doesn't allow for polyadic, doesn't allow for feedback, doesn't allow for what you're talking to Kurt Jomangal talking about, like non-commutator and all kinds of systemic, all different ways that things can relate can't be even captured through statistics in a Bayesian way. So you're still just, you're just, you know, curve fitting. And the modern AIs that we're dealing with are just doing that on steroids. And so they'll never be able to explain themselves because they don't have the explanatory machinery that we have, which is that when we go to that layer, that natural intelligence layer, that ineffable layer, it's inevitable, but it makes sense. And it makes sense, and this is what I'm arguing, because of these impossibilities that we know things we don't know we know that are incredibly powerful about continuity, conservation, uniqueness, this common sense stuff we know. If you're trying to write programs to do it, they blow up. Like they're incredibly huge. They're global optimization. They're incredibly hard to get a system to simulate everything right. But we do it right. Like when we go through life, we have a seamless, continuous, very complex simulation of reality happening lightning fast. That's incredibly reliable. The lines aren't wiggling and things don't all of a sudden jump to the more correct version. Like this keeps up with the speed of life beautifully, and you can count on that, right? And so, so what we say is that, like, yeah, that you, this construed world we know about that we're imagining into, we're not seeing the real world, we're seeing our imagining of it. We only sample little points and somehow construe this huge, you know, projection that's incredibly reliable. Every time it's right where I thought it would be. It's like incredible. So that same machinery we can tap into much simpler problems that we think are much harder because we're blocking ourselves by formulating it in ways that don't hit that layer. They can't tap into that framework because they're stuck in the statistical or just stuck in the factual, and they can't run, they don't hit that. So that's the natural intelligence promise is to, hey, we've got untapped potential that we've been blocking ourselves. And that's such a huge amount of potential that we reverse the problem. So it's back to what you originally asked me. In climate science, we say we don't understand the climate. We know it's our CO2 making a difference. It's out of our tailpipes that we dug up from under the ground. If we stop doing that, we'll stop this source of change that is clearly a problem. And I say the same thing, that we already know we're doing this huge thing to block our natural intelligence that makes us crazy, that we can't situate things, that we get caught in all kinds of processes because we can't tap into the thing that will simplify, clarify, allow for insight, allow for us to return to a consistent, quiet, livable simulation of reality. Like, we can't get back to that. And so if we remove that, I'm saying that that is a necessary condition for a sane world, because this other thing's insane. And might even be sufficient. And that's where I talk about the meta crisis. Like, until we do that, it might even be sufficient, because all kinds of other things will emerge from it. Because if you know, if you're walking around the blind, trying to ski downhill with the blindfold, first thing, remove the blindfold and see what this thing can do, you know?
Right. Yeah. All right. That's beautiful. All right. So we're going to deconstruct that a little bit. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So there's a fundamental, you know, system available to us for sense making, natural intelligence.
Right.
We have our, so tell me a little bit about how we corrupt this natural system via, you know, parasitic process, or give me a frame for what is happening to the system.
Right.
How are we corrupting this system? How can we point to it and be like, oh my God, this is how we're corrupting it. And this is how we can remove these parasites and get more the clean core operating system, if you want to call it that or whatever.
So the idea, and this is also backed up through the Johnson Laird emotional, like his model of that there's this interesting thing that people are kind of hyper-rational when you think they'd be irrational. So kind of, I know that's right in your wheelhouse, because Beck had their rationality problem, and this is kind of the opposite of that. The idea is that for something to be parasitic, it would have to be kind of in this closed loop cycle. And then, and that if that has a negative valence, then you could actually have a feedback where you start a downward spiral. Maybe you're reciprocal narrowing. I mean, the way to think about it, but basically people just say it. They're like, oh, I'm spiraling. You know, I'm like, and you can
call that a neurotic loop, or
again. Yeah, whatever. Yeah, you call it neurotic loop. So lots of people sense that's what's going on. You're going around circles, you're ruminating, you know, turning around circles. So basically the idea is that in the lower level logical system that we're familiar with, if you follow the causality of that loop, this is what Johnson Laird would say, each step is reasonable. Like, I'm washing my hands because I might get a disease, and now I've touched something and now I might also get a disease, so I need to go wash my hands, and I touch something again, and I gotta wash my hands. Like, that is all true. If you wash your hands, you're less likely to get a disease. Oh, you just touched something, you're more likely to get a disease. Go wash your hands, you're less likely to get a disease. Your life will be better because you won't get a disease. You won't get a disease. Your life will be better. And then you have to stop a person and be like, is that your whole life? And they're like, what? And so, like, it's right away, this calmo is like, how do you get people out of the loop? And just, and there can be various things that restore recognizing that it's, so the thing is that there's a, it's too limited, you know, that's one thing that would go wrong. It right away restore itself. You just give people the self-distance. This is the work that Aslam Aydak and the construal level theory, you're kind of looking at like self-distancing just as a basic fundamental mechanism, and actually teasing apart more recently that in writing you can kind of look for that signature and see like, that's now it's effective as, you know, the Pennebaker journaling, you know, will be effective. So ruminating, meaning making right away might just be the distancing move. You can get someone to do that. And I think that's completely aligned with the Calmo thing, you know, sure it's in there. So that might happen, right? But what if that loop is not situatable like that? Like, that's, you know, what if the loop is just something that is a nonsensical causal structure that you're not allowed to question, either, you know, because of authoritarian reasons or because it can't be grounded, because it's like, well, we know 40% of women are like this, 60% of men are like that. So this must be because men are doing this and women are doing that. Like, okay, what are you gonna do with that? Like, and you know, if that's your way to explain the world, you can't ground 40% of women and 60% of men into your direct experience. And if you do, you'd be considered to be doing cherry picking or anecdotal evidence, right? So when you go looking for a mechanism, you'll be going against kind of this, like, well, what are you arguing with the stats? You know, so you get this weird, and then we know all statistical models, Judea Pearl's thing, you can always have confounds in statistical models. Simpson's paradox shows you how you can have like completely opposite interpretations that are hidden because there can be all kinds of hidden variables. And you, if you're not asking the mechanism or the causality of that system, you don't break it open like that, you'll never know. And you'll just, and you see that all over the place in, I mean, it's ridiculous. And the psychedelic research people right now are just going around and I'm like, you know, at one point, if everyone's telling you I'm having a mystical experience, you're going to have to take them seriously. Someday you're going to have to take them seriously that that's what the effective mechanism is. Like, you can't keep trying to hammer it into, you know, anyway, you just see people going around these loops. And you're like, anyone common sense would see, you know, what are you doing here? You can just go ask a million people and they'll tell you what the mechanism is of a psychedelic experience. I thought reality was this. I found it's malleable. If I know I can change my reality, I'm free. Like, you know, like it's a tool of recognition, of liberation, you know, from the very first psychedelic, correct psychedelic trip to start to see the meta of your construal reality, to for people to understand that about themselves is the hugest tool ever, because they may not know how to do it, but they all know that's an option. So their whole possibility framework is just blown open. And now they can return to a curiosity and start to unpack all the kinds of other things, right? So that's just common sense. And anyone who did psychedelics illegally, I guess, as a young person, the Valley back to the 60s, yes. Like, my mind's been psychedelicized, the Chamber Brothers, to, you know, and my mind's been psychedelicized. But that's not showing up because people are caught in these little frameworks. So basically you can see it happening in action there. Other factors, you know, so one thing that is important to realize is that we have models, we create models all the time, they get reified and they work really well. And then they have like this kind of hysteresis, like you go into a new environment, you're still using that model. So at that point, that model might already be parasitic and confabulatory. You just haven't realized it yet. You know, this always worked. Why does it not work here? You know, people always love when I talk all the time. Like, why am I, you're in a culture that wants you to shut up. Like, oh, it took me a while to figure that out. Why is everyone looking at me? You know, so you got this little hysteresis, your model doesn't work anymore. And then you eventually figure that out. And the thing I think that people miss is that for one thing, time. You know, time, and there's two disruptive things going on. Like, if you think about what happens with insight, you know, you first have to be, you probably want to be in a private place. And this is borne out by the wisdom research. So you want to do it in solitude. You can see one standard deviation increase in the amount of wisdom if you give people 5 minutes alone to reflect on the same question versus having them speak aloud to you in person. Gotcha. So that reflection time is huge. And if you just step back and think about it, what is your mind doing in an insight process? It is giving itself permission. It doesn't know what's going to happen. Insight doesn't, it's not linear. Uh-huh. Any part, you go in thinking, well, you know, I think the thing that doesn't add up here is that this person's just late for my meeting, and you go off and like think about it. You're like, wait, they're late for all my meetings, and what about that? And also, you're like, this person's been lying to me. This whole thing's not going to work. You know, like you need to go off and say, when something doesn't add up, you don't know how deep that fissure is. You just see, mm-hmm. I'm seeing at this level something doesn't add up, and so that process of having the time to unpack it, having to deal with the repercussions. I think Nora's talked about this recently, like readying yourself to be able to do that work. Takes time, takes space, takes energetic resources. It takes, you know, ability to adapt. Sometimes you have to just go along with things as they are. And that all needs to be respected. I don't think people are very good at respecting that. That all needs to be respected. So it can just literally be time, energy constraints on people's minds that are going to keep them in the loops. Gotcha. For as long as it needs to happen. And if you think about shared fictions, like the society's engaging in shared fictions, that's what we do. And in some ways, the whole social pressure to conform to a set of social standards to keep us from being surprising, so that you don't have to do that kind of processing real time. Like you need people to, so being a free thinker is very threatening to the group, because real time, if you're not acting in this kind of way that is super protocol, that we can't go together really quickly towards this, off this cliff together. Yep. And then you're like, wait, we're going off the cliff together. You know, it's like, kill them, you know, like kill that person. We're going off this cliff together. So, you know, recognizing that there's a lot of social threat to doing that process. And just understand the mechanics of all that. So, you know, it might be better to go off the cliff with a bunch of lemmings than try to stop the stampede. You might be like, oh, well, here we go. You know, like I see this, but I'm not going to enact it. So I think that all these things keep us in kind of the momentum of the model that worked. And then the time squeeze is what Ian McGilchrist really brings in, with the fact that you can track it beautifully to the fact that we have two attention systems, that we do want to model Newtonian parts when we're in a tight time squeeze life death situation. That's where we have to guess projectiles, intentions, trajectories, you know, what do you want from, you know, you're guessing, you're modeling this person, what are they going to do so that you can bite them before they bite you, you know, like that whole combat thing of being an animated, you know, plants theory don't need to do this so much because they can't move, but us that have to move, we have to go Newtonian all the time. We're in land of projectiles.
This becomes a crucial point about being minded, by the way, but
right. No, I know you talked about that. And I'd say like, it's a new category comes in. I know you talk about that with the animal mind. From the plant mind, which may have much more than the animal mind. So it's like, if movement's one of your options, now you have new things you can model.
It opens up a whole nother world.
Yeah. And then I was speculating also, like, let's say you're truly solitary cat, or maybe even an octopus is a better example. So you don't have a social context. Well, you don't worry about social context. You're never a part of a greater whole, but just about everything else, you know, has this little bit of sense of like, I am with us. So there's a we here, but you may not need we if for some animals, you may just not be a useful abstraction. Sure. So you have the different ways the minds learn to what they have to model in order to live. And that's what we kind of are calling natural intelligence, the machinery you get. You know, as being you. And then also that humility of like, we only got human machinery, you know, there could be things we can't imagine that would bring in better machinery. All the people hiding our socks and to sending them to other dimensions that are sharing our space. The aliens, the invisible aliens are smarter than us doing stuff.
is it your sense then that the modern condition is overloading us with parasitic process in a way that historically, was the oral indigenous period then much less likely to be? Do you look out at the modern world and be like, oh my God, it's the modern world is fusing us with parasitic process? How do you think about it in relationship to what modern society is doing relative to sort of a pre-modern state? Do you frame it in that terms at all?
I've been trying to understand from first principles, because I'm not an anthropologist, I don't have a large body of knowledge to speculate on. So I've been playing around with that a lot recently, thinking I have a couple things, which is that, you know, as social animals, right, there's definitely times when we want to all say the most important thing is to get the elephant, and we're all going to kill the elephant, and then we're all like charged up, like, we're all going to do this together. We're going to do this thing. And that the shared fiction matters and you don't question it. It's just like full on. And we become this super scary, super super predator pack animal that is in that Newtonian mode war. Like that's definitely something we have to be able to do. And then what I've speculated on is maybe that has been well balanced with the, in our previous days, there was enough time fireside, maybe fire really helped us out, like the two couldn't have existed without each other actually, because we've been too crazy. But you know, the time around when we invented fire, you know, the idea of like, we all have to huddle around this thing to stay warm, and we're not going anywhere. There's nothing really to do but just be warm and cook our food. That's all we're doing right now is being warm, and we're kind of being hypnotized by the fire. And like, this is maybe gave us that spaciousness to start to deconstruct together and maybe address some of the shared fiction, bring things up, have space for that. I mean, that's how I'd imagine would be the restorative healthy thing would be the collective natural intelligence have to come back on and start to deconstruct those shared fictions, say, you know, I was thinking, or, you know, I've got this hard question because like, it seems like the elephants are dying off and I'm not sure what we're going to do about that. Cause did you notice it took us like 3 days to get that one? It used to take one day. It's like, yeah, what are we going to do about that? What are we going to do about that? It's like, maybe we're not elephant hunters anymore. Whoa. You know, we're all just going to be staring that down, you know? So there might've been like that. It's totally speculative. There might've been that kind of way that we needed both parts to counterbalance each other. But I think we are obviously measurably in Western culture anemic for the spaces that allow for the natural collective intelligence to happen. If we measure the outcome as wisdom, this is Igor Grossman and others doing the studies showing that you can measure, you know, by their measures of wisdom, differences across culture. and people can kind of sense it too, that Americans and with and also our perspectival stuff are much more foreground background versus Asian cultures. Mm-hmm. That said, I do think the same way, anytime you can get someone's attention system trapped in either hemisphere, so I think you can be trapped the other way too, where you do not articulate things. You stay in, say, an affective frame where you just always like, how does that feel? How does that feel? How does that feel? How does that feel? Your senses, don't think about it. Like, you know, you don't conceptualize it, stay only in your senses. You also can trap someone's attention where they can't actually move forward in their natural intelligence. So I wouldn't say you have to be careful that I wouldn't say just always having background versus foreground attention means you're going to win. It's that it's the natural intelligence is based on the context, having the fluidity as we're designed, you know, as Ian Michael Chris points out, we're designed to be able to one side can suppress the other, you know, so we're designed to be completely fixated and obsessed and like, and we're designed to be completely blown out and, you know, downloading at source, whatever, you know, open and move between them.
A constructive opponent process between these two modes is what it is that's going to afford the most flexible, adaptive, complex landscaping that would be available.
Right. And if you can get people trapped on one side or the other, they're very exploitable because they can't sense make. And so they'll, you know, they, you can just like a robot, and I think that's a zombification. Maybe that maps to the thing. I haven't read Verveke's book on that, but maybe that's the zombie, you know, it makes sense. The zombie metaphor is also in the Emil Christ work when you feel as though people are doing things that are nonsensical and you can't seem to wake them up. It's that's their attention's trapped and you've got them. You've got them. And then basically we're living in a culture that everyone, you know, in the know, salesmen, everybody else, like, you know, marketers and as you know, the whole psychology of selling and why we went into the behaviorist model in the first place and brought the American Psychological Association here is to get people to buy things and everything else. And like, you know, that whole machinery is designed to trap our attention to control us and exploit us. So yeah, so this restoration move is of using, so we're saying the special thing is the open and inquiry, because what it can do is it's a little V, like the, you, no matter what the thing is that your attention's trapped on, the part, whatever that thing is, it's, you can articulate, conceptualize it if you can, give it, you know, distance enough that it becomes a, you know, I, it, I, thou, whatever you want to call it, you have a relationship to it. Once you've got that, now you can start to categorize it into something that affords itself to inquiry. And then you start to use a special kind of inquiry form, which you see happens naturally in therapy. This place we see is forms a lot, other places, interview questions, you know, memoir writers. And you get to start to bring back the sense making that will naturally reveal the emptiness of it, Buddhist concept of that, of every concept. It will reveal its emptiness. It might reveal its emptiness through dissolving, knowing it's nonsense, or it might reveal its emptiness because you'll start to see, as you do with inquiry, that that everything's processes and everything in the living system is kind of mutable on certain time scales, and that's made it's a transient that has emerged through the whole complex of processes that make it up. So there's nothing there other than everything else. And that's things made up of everything else. And that thing's made up of everything else. And you start to realize you're in this kind of network of emptiness that's very meaningful and rich. And yet there's nothing ever anywhere. So you don't get stuck up on it. It's you know, it's like, it's tubes, not balls. You're just sliding through frames and perspectives, like you slide through life, constructing this fluid simulation. Yeah.
Yes. Amen.
Yeah. There we go. Got it all worked out.
Well, I have a friend, Rob Scott, who talks a lot about what he calls identity shifting and then the fundamental identity shift. So identity shifting is essentially this whole move of, hey, you're in the lens and then you see the lens. And then you back up and you see the network of lenses. And then you see the sort of master lens of the self that's lensing all of this stuff together. Right. And then you ultimately get perspective on that. So the identity shifting is seeing all the lenses and then having the capacity to wonder, you know, what's a parasitic process, what's pure awareness, and then, oh God, what's the self? And then wait, the self is a lensing structure itself. And then all of a sudden you're, so he's you're doing actually a lot of, I think his whole coaching system overlaps a lot with the insights of what you're offering, because it's fundamentally this subject object move, and then the getting fluid and flexible and adaptive, and the layering of awareness in relationship to that, and the dissipative structures that then become what are rigid and real all of a sudden become fluid process, and it opens up a whole wide variety of different elements. So anyway, I just had some parallels there. But this inquire process is it's something that people can do.
Yeah, right. yes, they can. So maybe I should talk a little bit about that. What was surprising with the project started out when I quit my job to go try to deliver what the ladies had, what was I seeing there? First, I talked to the ladies and I said, wouldn't you love to do this with a bunch of 30-year-olds? And they're like, no. And I got to read up on what, everybody knows that people are not looking to expand their social network when they're dealing with existential givens towards the end of life and they're not having that hunger anymore. And it's like, just like, oh, so I have that to figure out. So I'm like, oh, how about it's a software system. Have you ever wanted to write your memoirs? And most people I talked to said, oh yeah, I'd love to, I've always wanted to, but I haven't. Why is that? And I kept hearing I'm not a writer. I don't know who to give them to. So the original idea is, well, why don't I think I can build, I know what I can build. I've been building for a long time, been an engineer for a long time. I think I can build a pretty good interview system to make it easier for you. And then I could put that on the internet and I could find people to give your memoir to that would be helpful. And I kind of just do this kind of wisdom exchange idea of let me just, anyone think probably in engineering, right? I can build tools and then I can match people that may want to hear your words because they're going through something similar. And wouldn't that be lovely? Someone's like, yeah, that'd be great. So I just went off to the races and I came up with five questions that I thought would be good questions. And I was like, and then I went to my friend, Dr. Susan Campbell, and I said, you've been a lifetime clinician person and psychiatrist. You think if there's any problem writing a software system that asks people these questions? It's like, oh, this seemed like safe questions to ask people, a good question. I'm like, great. Then I walked off and I thought, well, I just kind of came up with those. how many are there? And how many, what made them great? And what I was like, all of a sudden, are there more questions? My engineer brain is like, why would you stop there? And, and I probably would have actually had a pretty successful little startup if I was stopped there, because that's actually where you want to stop. But I'm much more of a scientist. Yeah, I couldn't help myself. And so I just went crazy for a year and a half, $600 in used books, cheapest Amazon, and just books of questions and questions and and what do people, what are these and what are good ones? And listening to Terry Gross interviews, why didn't she just ask them? Or what was implicitly asked? Or when someone said, oh, I just realized something, what would you ask them to have them reveal that? And it just turned into a year and a half of just trying to get at what that was and just to come up with kind of the first round, version one of the model. The model's gone through many revisions since then. And then also realizing they were tapering off. I wasn't finding unique forms. Once I started modeling them, I was like, oh, I'm not finding unique forms anymore. Then I started asking people, what are some great questions to ask people? I asked them, just like, oh, I got that one. And I was like, oh, this is getting pretty complete here, which is fascinating to me as a model builder, right? That's really cool. When you realize that that's something complete, you can build a lot with that. So that's what the project, it became like that. And then against it, having a long history in meditation things, and also just asking myself, how would you have these insights and doing all these thought experiments and testing these question forms, I became very aware of the semantics of the question. I became very aware of the feel when you ask a good question, I think I already had a lot of that, but it was super dialed in where it's I could just almost go by my sense of feeling of better, better, better. And then I'd run it against a whole bunch of scenarios I had kind of lined up, that's a better form. So there's a whole bunch of language engineering of what to remove, removing biases, finding the right word. So it's polishing lenses. So I almost feel like me and my co-founder were watchmakers. We're in there trying to use really precise language engineering. We'll spend a whole day tweaking a word sometimes, if it's in the question forms. And so there's a lot of science to be done on this. You came up with about 1,000 forms. But they're good enough. It appeared to be good enough for people. And so what happened kind of by the by with this is I ended up with that model. It was still supposed to be a memoir engine. I threw it to my sister because I always wanted to write his story about this pony she had. She has these great stories. I'm like, please write the memoir of your story with your pony. And she started using it to work out issues with her girlfriends and her husband. And she says, this could really help people. I'm like, you really need to put it out there because it could really help people. And I was like, I'm not doing a therapy tool. I know this world. I'm like, oh God, no. And she's like, no, you have to. And so it was a lot of moral, because I just thought, what a troublesome domain to try to, that's a hard domain. I don't have the credentials for that. everything else.
So at this stage in the game, is it then it's a memoir?
That was the idea. It would be a tool for old people to pull out their life wisdom.
Pull that system where you had that experience. Okay.
Yeah, pull out those stories from your life. Like, what got you over? What was it like? What, all the meaningful questions, so people could hear those stories, right? And so, but the moment I realized, so then I was in QA testing the system, and all I did was write down three like simple, when you're QAing or quality assuring your software, you come up with really simple unit tests. They're just the simplest thing. So I wrote down the simplest three things from my life, positive, negative, neutral, because I want to check for if I had any kind of bias in the questioning that would kind of, because I would have hunches like, it's probably better. And I was trying to remove all my biases I'm fogging on the words. We're getting close to the hour there. My brain's starting to fade. So anyway, I just ran my own life, 36 aspects, all the categories, systematically, where I could see every collision and every, and every 20 minutes or so, I'd have this like insight, like cathartic cry, step away from the QA, go as fast as I can. I'm not trying to have insights. My mind's just doing it. And it's just saying, and the quality of the insights I can talk about, I talk about in the whole series, we're not going to go into here, but it's because when you build an artificial system and you get even that simple, you get over an associative bias and you start to see all these overgeneralizations you have. And they in themselves are these parasitic processes in a sense, because you don't, they're unrecognized ways you think the world works. Like, oh, I always knew I was unattractive and had a big nose. You know, that was one of my things. My dad has a very big nose. My mom said, you have your father's nose. So I'd be like, I'm not only like have a grotesque nose, I'm delusional that I don't see it, you know, like, and so I'm a delusional person with a grotesque feature I can't see, you know. And then later in life, I'm like, mom, you know, okay, I see it, but no, I mean, my nose is fine. Like, you know, but you still have this weird thing, you know, when you're a kid, you're like, you just, all, everything sticks in the wrong way. So you just kind of see these are everywhere. And so there's this low hanging fruit. It's what the memoir writers talk about, that they get a new lease on life, that they refer to the memory, not their memoir. It's transformative. So people were saying to me, you've totally changed. And I could feel it. I was like, this has done a really, so then I was really like, oh my gosh, this is even bigger than I thought. This capability of mixing technology and this way of kind of laying down these breadcrumbs in your psyche so that you can see all that dissonance and how the dissonance isn't troublesome. It's relieving. You're like, usually just, those things are still true in context. They're just not so big. They're just nuanced, and everything becomes nicely nuanced. And then you start to also realize through that process, I realized that all the ways I'd overgeneralized, I was missing all the complexity of my life and all the ways I was quite brilliant as a living thing in a very ordinary way, that my life was like, I was brilliant, but ordinary. And that like I second guessing my brain was how I was creating a lot of unnecessary suffering and all the ways I was doing that. And you see it everywhere, this wall of psychological armchair, like you're being this, you're this kind of person, you got this kind of behavior, this kind of personality. All that stuff was just like tormenting me. You know, I accumulated tons of it through my 30s. I was just walking around with all this self-judgment that was kind of trying to be helpful. And I almost thought about writing a book of like, you know, self, I think the way people got onto this is self-help as self-abuse. Like it was, that was a lot of the quality of it, of like, you know, and all that just started getting stripped away. And my life just felt very ordinary, coherent, like, finite and embedded and manageable, so that I could see past it and really feel open to life. I could see that openness to life. Like I've got enough energy now that I can just like move on. Like it all felt very big and vast when you're overgeneralizing here and then overgeneralizing there. And it all just starts to get very like, you know, very ordinary. You wake up from all those dreams. So when people talk about waking up, I'm like, from what to what? There's like thousands of awakenings. There are all these little awakenings all over the place. And, you know, and maybe there's some global stuff that's kind of cool, of like that kind of finiteness feel, of like manageable feel. It's very relieving, and that restored confidence in yourself, the limitation of that part of your mind that's going to second guess you versus the vastness of the part of you that knows, like restoring that kind of faith in yourself. All that was happening. And yeah, so basically that kind of cinched the deal on this thing becoming also a personal growth tool. So yeah, people can just show up and it's really simple. It'll feel just like, you'll, even if you don't say, it's like therapy, people will say, you know, if you say, if you've done meditation, how's it compared to meditation? If you've done journaling, how's it compared to journaling? If you've done therapy, how's it compared to therapy? And people just say like, you know, this is therapy. You know, they just like, this is obviously therapy. So that, if you wonder what it feels like, it's like being asked those kind of open questions. But the added benefit of doing it with a software system which I only realized much later, also working with it, is that that when people ask you questions, they can't pull them from anywhere. There's a thousand mm-hmm. forms, right? They're thinking along with you. They're modeling your life. And when mm-hmm. they ask you a question, it's not out of the blue. You're always thinking, why would their mind go there? Why would you ask that? And so I take questions that for me were very private. I thought if someone asked me that, I feel so defensive. Like, why would you even think that to ask me that, that I wouldn't want to answer honestly. But with the software, it's super obvious. It's like, you know, here's the menu. Oh, you know, that one, like, and you can kind of have, it's much safer. And so this whole idea of like resistance and people not wanting to look at things, like there's been a lot of emergent understanding of like how much more compassion we could bring to this growth process, that people want to, they want to have insights. They want to see things. They want to see the low hanging fruit. They want to do it privately. They will not react poorly to it. But the caveat that we teach is that you have this beautiful mechanism that seems to be very reliable, which is your curiosity. Your curiosity will tell you when you're ready. If you're not feeling curious, don't do it and hold that ground. Like, just wait, because that's a trustable instinct. So we try to kind of, you go from a bother, something's bothering you, and you might be like, oh, it bothers me. I don't want to go there. And then just wait. As you look around, when your brain thinks it's manageable, you're going to get this drive all of a sudden and say, you know what? What is that? What is that? You know, like you can't. So trusting that arc, trusting yourself, that also came out from this process of being able to do things in solitude, is that no one's interfering with that. It's very easy for you to keep tuning into that. Yeah.
So in terms of like, where do you feel like it is in terms of it's a development? Is the system, are you still developing the system? Is the system ready to lay out? Is it how to translate it at a large scale? Where are you in terms of the?
Oh yeah, it's people can go use it. And how it's worked is that because it's so incredibly private for many years, we really just thought this is helpful, let's people have at it. But we knew it was hard to use too. We really want to democratize it. And I think we tried to do that too fast. So we were like, you know, you could get this for pennies. It's so slow. You'd like, we send you a question, like in terms of technology, here's a question, go think about it for an hour. You know, it's like, we can serve 100,000 people on a $5 server. It's like, you know, it's not like YouTube, right? Uh-huh. So scaling is not a problem. Uh-huh. But what we realized is a problem is that that there's a lot actually still training that people get people blocked on this process. And so we've slowed it down to where we only are making it available with people that we know are getting a full training and really staying in the loop with them and really talking to them. So we're really generous with our time, making sure they don't get stuck. Cause our goal right now is to make sure, like people say, oh, that was great. But then we start looking at the logs, like, well, all you really did was journal. Like you didn't really get in there. Like there's no way you got to see this, and this possibility. Mm. So now if we can be in relationship to the first 1,000 users, we can keep in dialogue with like, well, you know, what specifically you're working on, but how far, what kind of things you've been doing? Are you wanting to maybe do this bigger thing and try to coach people through, you know, really big deliverables and just watch them through that. So that's the idea. And then once we have that, hopefully that community can support others and we can democratize from there. That, you know, because it's not actually that hard. It's like a lot of things. Like I said, there's things get in the way. It's like windsurfing. Once you get it, or riding a bike, once you get it, you got it. But you need that kind of initial investment to get people back in it. And once they get it. So I think a lot of people could just coach each other. It's just moves you got to learn. Okay. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And so, yeah, that's ready to go. And then we're putting out a book of all the forms. Okay. And yeah, our hope there, which I talked about in the Stoa series, our four-part series, in the fourth part, I talk about, I've kind of named this thing that I came up with, which is this idea, and I know you speak to this, that the, you know, you have clinical psychology has come up with all these different ways, and you can actually map them into this graph based on kind of these dominant modes, or even these dominant processes. And so there's no problem with that. We want that, you know, ideally you'd want that coupled to it's coupled to a context. You want to be like, someone comes in like, I have this challenging belief. Well, let's talk about that belief. Like you do want to help people get there, right? The problem is if you're married and like, where in psychology, clinical psychology, do you actually say, here's your full menu of options, and kind of saying like, if you're dealing with somebody and they're not getting there, you know, and you feel like you're what you feel like they need is have some insights, or they, you know, they don't feel like they're finding the plausible change in their life to move forward. This could serve as like a cheat sheet to say, well, here's all the other places maybe you haven't looked. It wouldn't be necessarily coupled to it. You'd have to rely on your own professional tacit knowledge to know how to deploy it, but at least maybe get you to imagine yourself the moves you may have missed, because there's so many, you know, it's like, yeah. And it is one of those weird things where when you're looking in one direction, you're just looking at beliefs. Beliefs feel like everything, or you're just looking at identity. Identity is everything. So it helps to have something move, because it's a hard move to pull back and go in a whole different dimension.
Totally.
So if you have a little cheat sheet, so we're going to just release this kind of handbook that's all the forms, 1,000 forms in like kind of a Mad Lib form. So anyone who uses questions for their professional life could start to deliver this value. Because people shouldn't be stuck, right? If people are stuck and you're the one caring for them, we'd want to give people tools so people can become, help them become unstuck, however, that, whatever that looks like. So that's, so, and then we are going to continue to support other people that aren't maybe in that profession directly with the forms, however, you know, case by case, however is necessary.
So there's both the clientele, and you're also seeing service professionals utilizing this in ways of fostering guides for flexible adaptive thinking, or supplements,
true client centered they can just check themselves, like, how, you know, they could even build models with it. And eventually we, you know, if there's, as I, the little bit of talking I've done with well, I guess it hasn't been that many over a decade, but the, the sociologists I've talked to and the clinicians I've talked to give them a full software suite, which we could do, visualization tools and like modeling tools and everything, they, that will disrupt a lot of their workflow. And so I think kind of the book is the first entryway, because I think that's the idea, is you can just go offline and you can kind of get you familiar with it, at least see how that's working first before now log into the system, you know, but there's a lot you could do with software as well to model people, to generate the questions dynamically and everything in a session or between sessions. So another thing, like, we will be coming to market with soon, and this is another feedback I got, is some people work with homework, some don't, but if you, but in our perfect world, if we're in charge of redesigning all of, you know, clinical psychology, we would say, is there a way you can do everything but this 5-minute reflective stuff in the session? So whatever that looks like, you know, empathy, support, what if, whatever you do, do what you do. And that one part where you want to ask them those open questions, can you just give them, get them to do it as homework? And we can give them like a homework system. Like, you can jot it down. You can know, this is what we're talking about. We're talking about your mother and this thing that happened, right? That's the thing you wrote. Yeah, that's what we're talking about. Okay, I give you a few questions as homework. And then we'd be kind of a homework tool to make that really easy, that someone using the tool could start with those questions you gave them, but also be like, here's some other ones too, if you want to keep going, you know, or related things. You can go as deep as you want on your own. It's, it's, and people might be able to service a lot of it and then just cycle back in a week and just kind of re-up, here's where I'm at, here's what's up for me working with, you know. So, you know, we've speculated that you could take an hour session down, maybe a 20-minute session even, you know, and then, you know, how that frees up a lot of resources. And then the person can use more than that 40 minutes. They can go for hours and hours as deep as they want to go in private, then check back and keep going in the iterative manner.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Okay. Thank you. So I hear the book. Are you then trying to then, like, seeing ways in which this can be, what I'm hearing then is that sort of the delivery model of it is being crafted now, in terms of, like, how do you onboard people, who you connect them with professionally, how do you deliver it to them so that then this product can be genuinely implemented in a wide variety of different domains? Is that fair?
Yeah, that's kind of where we're at. And just figuring out where it fits in people's world. Like, I know we've talked also, Daniel Thorson, I'm sure we both have had conversations with or seen different contexts. In his estimation, there's a lot of people that run retreat centers that have to do a lot of this unwilling psychological work. Like, they'd rather be doing the spiritual stuff, but people, psychological stuff comes up. So that might be a good market too, is people that are trying to do these other experiences could have people go off alone with this tool. And because empathy fatigue, right, is a real problem with a lot of people, that having to actively listen, you know, and whatnot. And so helping people deliver what they want to deliver and not have to do this part. So, you know, as long as, again, the only, we realize the only, you know, thing we have to be careful with, you know, to respect, is that, you know, people are treating mental health, mental illness, like, they need to be the judge. You know, we're not telling them how to do their job. We're just saying, for an ordinary person, you know, who is saying, I'm just trying to make sense of something, you've identified, ah, it looks like you want to make sense of something, do you want some good questions? There's that, that could, you know, take care of a lot of time and resources, so that people are freed up to handle the really intensive cases that they're trained to do.
Well, it overlaps a lot with, I mean, in terms of you know, we talked a little bit. So central to UTalk or on the applied side is this thing called CalmMO. And basically, and I don't have my license anymore. I voluntarily gave it up in part because it's, for me, it's unbelievably crucial to distill some of the core wisdom elements that really cut across the different perspectives. I think it also goes into other wisdom traditions outside, you know, Eastern wisdom traditions. And essentially what we're talking about is a fundamental shift, is a Rob Scott term, but a shift in perspective, a distancing metacognitive perspective, and a shift in the flexibility with which you then relate to these kinds of elements, and then to bring a questioning mindset that affords the capacity both to change the frame and then resonate with a particular type of frame, and to develop that capacity as opposed to getting trapped in that reciprocal looping parasitic structure is really foundationally crucial to this.
Yeah, and just understand that whole pipeline that is describable, and that comes back to kind of like the science is in. Like, we could really go to town, you know, if we had like a whole, you know, just as deep as people want to go into like all the things that justify that this is how it works. And it's kind of like you see the same pattern over and over, and you're already doing that work with the CalmMO. And yeah, and we have a similar way of saying it, like we try to remove the things getting in the way. And now you're in the pipeline of sense making, which is like now your mind's ready to do the reflective thing and do the updating and whatnot. Yeah. And in some ways too, the questions can do a lot of heavy lifting, which is nice, which we kind of under, you know, my co-founders, you know, for years he would skip the CalmMO step. I just let him use the software however he wants. And he's like, as soon as I can get anything articulated and start working with the questions, it kind of does that work. More recently, he's been experimenting more. He's like, oh, this is kind of nice too. So like, he's kind of, you know, young people have a lot of energy. So like, I spent a lot of time in the CalmMO. I'm like, oh, I'm just going to hang out here.
Was there, so we covered a fair amount of ground. Were there anything definitely that you wanted to bring to this conversation coming in today that we didn't touch on?
Well, I think that we touched on a lot of things. And I'd be curious also if there's things you want to come back to, but I think that there is some of this issue with, maybe there's not much to say about it. I think we pointed to it. I guess like I pointed a lot of things. I pointed like I'm going through my notes that there was a methodological split between maybe how both of us are dealing with, you know, models and all this. And I see a lot of people, I feel like there's this unnatural contention I'm having right now with the liminal web with some players in particular that have this both and philosophy that like basically for me to say, there's a root generator and something's axiomatic and, you know, kind of also defending, you know, you can't give that a color. You can't call me a name or give me a color or even give me a psychological diagnosis and shut this down. Like, this is an argument. It's a reasoned argument. But the fact that I would say that, the fact that I'd make such a claim almost is considered reductive. And I think that's something maybe I'll unpack with Layman more. He thought that was an interesting topic too, that I think we're in an interesting time right now. We need to understand almost like I was talking about those two spaces of like global versus local. Reductive in process space is what we want. Reductive in part space is what we don't want. So reductive in process space means gravity. You know, you got mass, we've got gravity. Don't have to worry about it anymore. You don't have to like recalibrate your scale every day. You know, the earth doesn't change size. The gravitational constant doesn't change. That process is always there. That's not reductive. That's something we know. It's impossible for something to have mass, not gravity. That's an impossibility. So, and I think you also talked about the Tina principle. There's no other way. This is it. That's how you, that is important stuff. And if you, if your model is like both and, or no, that's reductive, or you, like when Nora tries to make an argument, it's abductive inference. And people say, you're making it too black and white. You're not being nuanced enough. I'm it's always wrong to be that black and white. Like, so they're being black and white. But yeah, like that, that you, you, that's not, that's problematic. And it's really hard to push back on. And so, I've had to leave some communities because it's gotten so hard for me to kind of take these stands. And another problematic thing with the liminal web is that a lot of people don't have training in science, are applying science, fields of science in kind of this global interpretive way to kind of construe their theories as people do. But I think there's like a lack of recognition. That's the reductive movie we want to avoid, actually, to say that there's only one model, because these things are not, there's epistemic humility. It says these things aren't knowable. And if you really study even these big physics models of, like, you know, the big, if you go on big physics of big history, you're free to adopt them, but you have to recognize that, like, there are lots of contenders and there's lots of problems. And and so there's like a little bit of a lack of humility when I kind of point out, and particularly around thermodynamics, and it's not just this community, but it's also the scientific community. Me and Lee Cronin are both actively pushing back on, like, you know, there's, and other people I know that are my friend who showed you can make a cart go downwind faster than the wind. Voice. He's been a controversial character 15 years and right. And so we met, he's a paraglider pilot too. We caught up recently. We both like shouted at the same time, pointing at each other for closed systems that are non-interacting. That's what the second law, you know, and like, because we both have dealt with it a million times. Like, people don't understand the second law. And we're like, so there's a little bit of that going on where I'll say something where people are like, you can't disagree with the second law. And right away, no one's going to listen to me anymore. So that's happened a few times where like, I'll say, you know, I promise you, if you are, instead of rejecting my ridiculous claim, you force my feet to the fire, we might have a really interesting discussion. And that's what I want you to do. Force my feet to the fire if you think I'm being reductive or overgeneralizing. And like, we'll get there. But I don't really see a hunger for that. And I think it might be a little bit of, yeah, I'm curious about it. It's fine. It's doing what people do, but it's was kind of what was the end of the intellectual dark web, supposedly, is that everybody eventually just started supporting each other's position. And I know we talked, you invited like criticism, and I thought that was interesting. And I don't know if we want to do it live, but like, I was like, sure, we can, we can like try to model what this, you know, critical discourse could look like.
I'd welcome
and
that.
Yeah. And likewise, right. So that's what I'm wanting. Okay. I'm wanting people to say, oh, I see what you did there. Did you know this paper you referenced, because we finally got down to that layer, has a problem? And I would be like, I need to know that, you know, I want to and need to know that, because I'm counting on that person being right. And that, what am I missing? I'm not claiming, my argument is not claiming global galaxy mind. My argument is saying, when I cobble together after hunting very hard at the academy across 35 different fields and finding stuff I thought was credible and put it together, I can actually make an argument that says something, just like I would do with the climate, saying between you know, the atomic decay and carbon underground and the way the, you know, there's like a bunch of physics I bring together that is trustworthy to cobble together. I'm like, we don't know how the climate works. We know we should stop dumping CO2 into it. And so I'm saying, how would I have an opportunity to make that argument? I'm like, so hopefully the book, Layman thinks the book will show proof of work. Like, I've worked really hard at this. Here's a giant book. It's 800 pages, 1,000 forms. You know, it's you don't do it casually. So there's something there. But yeah, I think in general, like, and then also acknowledging the natural conflict of interest. So I think that both of us are working outside the academy for that freedom to go at the speed of truth and hold on to our strongly held opinions lightly. You know, that's a special situation to be in for both of us. Like, I coupled my company to it. The mission statement is that create a world that makes sense. If our theories don't make sense, we have to fix them. We're bounded legally to like fix our model to the best understanding. Like, it's not even optional, right? So I have to stay fluid. We don't claim our own knowledge. We tacit knowledge other than maybe how to build a system, but we really rely on the knowledge out there. So both of us in that position, this idea of what we want that the academy doesn't have, right? That freedom. And there might be others in the community that have that fluidity, you know? So maybe identifying who has that fluidity, but who's also would lose livelihood or lose, have these harms that the academy would have to have their models disrupted. If we did painfully kind of did that assessment of the, like, are you wanting to like kind of enter this arena where we're going to just try to shred things because we care more about truth. That's how we're approaching the problem.
Totally.
Yeah. Like I would love to kind of have that formalized.
Maybe we'll have, you know, that this is actually a nice setup for us to maybe circle back in and have a conversation with that as a frame.
Yeah, I think so. And shred's probably too harsh, but you know, I mean,
I mean, certainly, I mean, I'm, you know, I get trained as a scientist. My dad's a skeptical professor. I can relate and the need for it from my vantage point. This is absolutely, if we're actually going to generate something, whatever this sort of movement is, if we're calling for something that actually is transformative, if we're in trouble, we have to build off of something. I mean, I don't see how you could argue anything other than that thing better be sound. And then it's only going to become sound if there is a particular kind of critique brought to bear in relationship to it, not in a way that is humiliating or shaming or ego-based, but fundamentally curious about what is true and what is logically defensible, what's evidentiarily corresponding, what is coherent in relationship, what is pragmatic. These are all lenses, and we better bring them, affirming them for those that have belief in a particular way that listen, and then critiquing them in a particular way, because that's the best way that you're going to evolve a particular kind of structure.
Yeah, and I think that it's a way to keep the community alive. That's what living systems do, you know. So it's really almost inviting the pure intelligent natural intelligence process over the social, right? So yeah, and it's hard. I mean, again, I think acknowledging the incentives that are in place, it's hard if you built your business around a model to change that model, right? And things can be disruptive to our model, but we know as a company, and I think a lot of people are out there in this boat, we care more about the problem than our solution. And we're not going to put anything out there that's harming people. Like, we'll just have to, it is what it is, you know, like the world will grow. And I started this project thinking I'm just a, you know, I was gonna say brick in the wall, wrong analogy, like, you know, but I'd hope to be something that, you know, when you say stand on shoulders, I stand on shoulders of giants, maybe I'll be, have a little bit of a contribution someone else can stand on. Like, that's the best you can hope for, you know? But yeah, and that's the ride I'm on, you know, maybe I'll be more than that, but I hope I can at least pull off that much. So
lovely. Well, we appreciate you sharing the ride that you've been on. It's been a fascinating ride to get to know, and I've certainly enjoyed and been enriched by the narrative and some degree of memoirs and the new insights.
Thank you. Likewise. So I appreciate it. And I really enjoyed reading about your model and seeing like your mind work and all the similar places we've gone. And I know we could probably, you know, do a whole another episode just on any one of those dimensions. There's still so much there.
Yeah. So we'll circle back and we'll find that. But for now, how about we bring this to a close? And thank you so much for coming on and sharing your vision. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a great day.